Part 20, Chapter 2. A bit lost in Char's 12-foot bed, a bit tense in this echoing, empty compound, Johnny was waiting for Kerr's return. It was getting very late, and he was wondering what the delay might be. But to pass the time, he was reading. Char, in packing, had tossed out odds and ends that he hadn't cared to take back to Cyclo with him, and one of them was a Cyclo infant's History of Cyclo. Maybe from Char's own early schooling, for it said under the coverleaf, in an immature scrawl, "Char's book. You stole it, so give it back." And then below that, "Or I'll claw you." Well, Char wouldn't claw anybody now. He was dead, by Turl's thrust, quite a time now. Because Kerr had mentioned underground mines, Johnny was mildly interested to learn that the whole of the Imperial City on Cyclo and all the surrounding area was a maze of deep and abandoned shafts and drifts. As long as 300,000 years ago, Cyclo had exhausted surface minerals and had developed semi-core techniques. Some of the shafts went down as far as 83 miles, and in some cases, that was within half a mile of the liquid core. How awfully hot those mines must have been. They could only be worked by machines, not living beings. The labyrinth was so extensive that it caused some buildings on the surface to sag from time to time. He was just reading about the first interplanetary war to end mineral starvation when Kerr came back. Kerr looked a bit grave, even through his face mask.
"Dunaldine's been arrested," he said.
Dunaldine, related Kerr, had arrived in a battle plane just at sunset and had gone to find quarters and supper. As he came out of the mess hall, two men in monkey skins with cross belts stepped out of the shadows and told him he was under arrest. A squad of several more were at a distance. They had taken Dunaldine in a ground car driven by Lars up to the big Capitol building, the one with the painted dome up in the ruined city. They pushed him into the courtroom, and the senior mayor planet started to charge him with a whole lot of crimes, like interrupting council projects and committing war, and had then looked at him more closely and said,
"You're not Tyler!"
and had called for the guard captain, and there'd been a row. Then this senior mayor made Dunaldine promise not to incite a war with Scotland over this, and had let him go. Dunaldine was back at the academy after taking Lars's car away from him, and he was all right. Kerr had had to wait to give him the message, and Dunaldine said to warn Johnny.
"It means,"
concluded Kerr,
"that they expected you to come in, and they've got their eyes out all over the place. We gotta work fast, be careful, and get you out of here as soon as we can."
Johnny and Angus ate a bit of the food Kerr had brought, and then went to sleep for 4 hours. Kerr had turned in his old room, sleeping in a breathe mask, for there was no breathe gas circulation in the general compound. They were at it again before dawn, working fast. Kerr had another disc recording of hammering and pounding, and he put it on. The kind of work they were doing didn't sound at all like ductwork. What they had to do now was plant eyes and picture transmitters so they could not be seen or detected. They attacked the lead glass dome and bored bullet holes in it, in the exact right places, getting around the problem of their being covered by the blinds, if drawn. The very top of one of these upper-level domes was much more thickly tinted than the sides, so the detectors, readers, Kerr called them, had to be up pretty high. The bullet holes also had to be starred out, which is to say, given hairline cracks to make it look like they had come in from the outside. For good measure, they put some in other domes and didn't repair them, so that the condition appeared more general than in just Turl's quarters. They sank readers and transmitters into the holes. Then they repaired the holes with one-way, see-through, bubble patch. They put more glass repair sealing roughly on the cracks. Each reader had a leaded iris in front of it and was in a little lead box. The result looked like a crudely repaired hole, fixed up in slovenly fashion by careless workmen. Each of these was focused on a different part of the work areas in the two rooms.
He won't fool with that,
grinned Kerr.
He'll be afraid he'll let his breathe gas out and air in.
It was afternoon by the time they completed the dome readers. They tested them with the probe and receivers. They went blind and undetectable with the probe on, and read everything in their path with the scope off. They took a short lunch break and turned off the disc that had been blasting their ears in. There was suddenly more din outside. Kerr went to the door and unbarred it. Lars got a whiff of breathe gas and backed up. He demanded Kerr to come out and talk to him right now.
You're interrupting our work,
said Kerr, but he went out in the hall.
You've got your nerve,
said Lars, quivering with rage.
You gave me a handful of junk that had radioactive dust on it. You got me in trouble. When I showed it to Terrell this morning, it started to explode when it got near his breathe mask. You knew it would. He almost beat me.
All right. We will clean up everything in here before we turn on any big amount of breathe gas.
Those were radioactive bullets,
shouted Lars.
All right. They came in through the dome. We'll find them all. Don't get so excited.
Trying to get me in trouble.
You stay out of here. It rots human bones, you know.
Lars didn't know. He backed up. He left. Angus said, when Kerr had come back in and barred the door.
Were they really radioactive bullets?
Kerr laughed and began to shove goo food in his mask. Johnny marveled. Kerr was the only Cyclo he had ever seen that could chew Kerbango with a mask on, and now he was eating goo food and talking with a mask on.
It was flitter,
said Kerr, laughing.
It's a compound that throws off blue sparks when sunlight hits it. I dusted some of it on the bullets. Harmless. A kid's toy.
He was laughing even harder. Then he sighed.
We had to explain the bullet hole, so we had to find some bullets. But that Turl, he is so clever that he sometimes can be awful dumb.
Johnny and Angus laughed with him. They could imagine Turl seeing the sparks when Lars held out the finds Kerr had given him and the sunlight setting off the blue sparks. Turl's conviction that the world was after him must have driven him halfway through the back wall of the cage. He would have thought his own breathe mask exhaust was setting off uranium. They were into the ductwork now, and they really did start hammering and pounding. The trick was to inset lead-irised readers into the duct vent intakes and exhausts around the room so that they could not be seen and yet, peering out of the dark depths of the vents, could read an exact portion of the workrooms. The ducts actually required some very fancy work of their own. Although Kerr was a midget, he could bend sheet iron with his paws like it was paper. Kerr fixed it so the ducts, as they entered and left the room, were rickety. If you touched them, they appeared to be in danger of coming apart and falling out. But in actual fact, the final fittings were armor welded. They set the readers into these, made sure the irises worked, put the ducts in place, and began on the circulator pumps. It was late evening by this time, but they worked straight on through. By about 1 a.m, they had completed a usable circulator system that would go on working. They felt they were running behind in time, so they didn't stop. They had the problem now of centralizing the transmissions of all the readers and getting them clear over to the academy, miles away. None of these readers could be powered and picked up from more than a few hundred feet away. They all had different frequencies to keep them apart, and this meant a bulky feeder system. Johnny worked on the probe some more and put an on-off remote in it that would turn off and on the multi-channeled feeder box. That was the easiest part. One mustn't have radio waves flying about with a probe on. The tough part of it was getting the transmission through to the academy. They solved it by using ground waves. Ground waves differ from air waves in that they can travel only through the ground. The aerial to send is a rod driven in the earth, and the aerial to receive is simply another. It takes a different wavelength band, so there was no danger of anything detecting it. Since ground waves were not in general use by the Earth's cyclos, it required a feverish fabrication of components, converting normal radio to ground wave. It was the fall of the year, and it was still dark when Angus and Kerr went screeching off to the academy to install the receivers and recorders, one unit in a toilet, one in an unused telephone box, and the third under a loose tile in front of the altar in the chapel. Johnny, meanwhile, buried the feeder outside the dome in the ground. He had the pretext ready of looking for power cables, but he didn't need it. The world slept. He shoved in fuel cartridges to run it for half a year or more, wrapped it in waterproofing, buried it in the hole, pounded in the ground aerial, and restored the turf. Nobody could detect the grass had even been touched. A hunter's skill in making deadfalls came in handy. Inside again, he checked. Every lead iris was working flawlessly. The readers were powered. They went on and off at the feeder. He let them run to give Angus and Kerr a signal to set their recorders to over at the academy. Johnny busied himself with placing and armor welding the desks and drawing board in place. No molecular cutter would ever dent those welds. At 8 o'clock, Angus and Kerr sauntered in as though just arriving for the day. They bolted the door and both turned huge grins on Johnny.
"It works,"
said Angus.
"We watched you laboring away and even read the serial number of your welding torch. We got all 15 readers on the screen."
He thrust out his hand.
"And here's the discs."
They replayed them. They could even see the grain in material, much less read numbers. They heaved a sigh of relief. Then Angus took Johnny by the shoulder and pointed to the door.
"We needed your skill and ideas up to now, but from here on it's just putting cream on the oatmeal to convince Turl. Every minute you stay here is a minute too long."
Kerr was already putting the rigged probe back in exactly the same place, arranging the cabinet just as it had been.
"When I took on this job and suspected you'd be coming,"
he said as he worked,
"I fueled a plane. It's the one exactly opposite the hangar door. 93 is the last of its serial numbers, all waiting for you. They don't want us, they want you."
"It will take us only 45 minutes or an hour to rig the rest. You get out of here, and that's an order from Sir Robert, to get you gone the moment you can leave."
Kerr now had relocked the door of the cabinet and was prying at the corner with a jimmy to make it appear it had been unsuccessfully tampered with without being opened.
"Goodbye,"
he said emphatically. Yes, it was true. They could handle the rest and were in no danger. But it was also true that it had to be completed. He would get ready and stand by in the plane.
"Come down and tell me when it's all done."
"You go."
Johnny gave them a salute and went out. They locked the door behind him. He went down the passage to Char's room to get his kit. It was 8:23 in the morning. Already 2 hours too late.